Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, as usual, and we've got a very special guest, and I think it is in line with the current theme for the month, which is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. We have with us one of the foremost integrative practitioners who deals with cancer. She's been a frequent guest. She has visited me previously on Health Talk. Now we have her on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. She's Dr. Lise Alschuler. She's written some great books. She's a naturopathic doctor. She's actually first among her profession to achieve board certification in naturopathic oncology. And she graduated initially from Brown University and, like me, majored in medical anthropology. We'll talk a little bit about that in just a few moments. She's also past president of the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians, and she's a current board member of the Oncology Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Naturopaths are increasingly working hand-in-hand with allopathic physicians to help patients with cancer. And she has written some great books. She is also herself a radio host. She is busily hosting a podcast and broadcast radio program entitled Five to Thrive. So welcome to the program. I'm just running out of time to share with our audience all your accomplishments and accolades. Did I miss anything in particular that you want to share?
Oh, no, I think that was good, and I appreciate that. Actually, did you mention, I think you did, I'm a cancer survivor. I have to just say
okay.
On that note, though, that,
yeah.
that October is kind of a big deal month for me because it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. It's the month I was diagnosed. This October, I'm celebrating my fifth year.
And that's a very important year, the five-year mark. That's great.
Yes, it is, and it's also my birthday month, so I like October.
Happy birthday. What's your birth date?
20th.
Okay, because mine the 7th, that would have been really weird.
Yeah, that would have been.
Because you're like my naturopathic alter ego. You were president of your organization, I was president of mine. You know, it goes on and on. All right. You also, just importantly, you wrote a book that I reference, you know, almost on a daily basis. There's not that many books that I keep within arm length. You know, I have lots and lots of books. My whole office is full of books. But this one I literally keep within grabbing distance. It's a book called The Definitive Guide to Cancer. And that is a book that is a very, very detailed and rigorous discussion of the various types of cancer, even the various types of chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and the compatibility and desirability of certain types of therapies. And, you know, you make a great point in that book, because if we're really going to be scientific about it, we can't just say rah, rah, rah about, you know, bring it on all the supplements in the world, you know, just swallow everything under the sun, because there's certain things that work well with cancer treatments and certain things that may work against cancer treatments. So it's important to differentiate on a scientific basis. And I thank you for writing that great book.
Well, thank you for having it at arm's length. That means a lot.
Yes, indeed. And for our listening audience, if you want a more, shall we say, user-friendly book for people who literally are coping with, well, post-cancer, you know, like you yourself, there are a lot of people, they've been successfully treated for cancer. But the concern is maintaining remission. What we sometimes call in medicine secondary prevention of cancer. You've got the cancer, it's been treated, but, you know, some people are waiting for the other shoe to drop, and they're awaiting diagnostic tests and scans to make sure that no cancer cells are returning. The book is The Definitive Guide to Thriving After Cancer, and that's a book that you've just reissued, right?
Yes, this is a really the second edition of our prior book, which is Five to Thrive, but we kind of made it more of a companion to the book that you mentioned earlier and updated it with new statistics. We rearranged the information so it's more accessible, kind of a more of a go-to plan for not only, like you said, reducing the risk of recurrence, but optimizing health in the meantime.
Okay, and you can find out more on the website that I'm looking at. It's 5tothriveplan.com, and 5 is spelled out. So it's F-I-V-E, 5tothriveplan.com. So why do you call it 5 to Thrive? What's the magic about 5?
Yeah, well, you know.
It rhymes with thrive.
Exactly, that was it. So then we had to think, what could we do with 5? No, right. Actually, it started off with 5, and really it starts from a very evidence-based concept, which was that after reading hundreds, probably thousands, actually, of articles on cancer, on what the factors that contribute to cancer, that contribute to the reduction of risk of cancer, we came up with this concept, and it's really not unique to us, but we sort of put it together, that there are five what we call superhighways of influence on our cells on a genetic level and on cell expression level that will the kind of the status of these five pathways will have the biggest influence on whether we experience health or we experience increased risk of diseases like cancer. So everything kind of stemmed from there. We took this concept of the five pathways, which are, by the way, the immune system is one, inflammation is two, hormone balance is three, insulin resistance is four, and then the fifth is digestion and detoxification.
Okay, write these down, listeners, because there will be a pop quiz at the end of this. What, those five, again, very important. We'll repeat them.
Yes, please. So the immune system, inflammation, hormone balance, insulin resistance, and then the last is digestion and detoxification.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously you're going to go into great detail in your books about the influence of each of these pathways, but, you know, introduce us.
Yeah, so these pathways essentially are the biggest influencers of through a process we call epigenetics. So epigenetics, I'm sure you've talked about on your show before, but it's basically how we influence the behavior of our genes. And depending on, for example, whether or not we have chronic inflammation in our body and all of the things that are attendant to that, we send certain messages to our genes and we cause our genes to behave in a certain way. So the state, in this example, of our inflammation in our tissues will determine whether our genes express in a way that creates more health or express it in a way that creates more opportunity for disease and derangement, such as cancer. So we really, you know, go through these pathways and kind of explain them. And we further found out that there's really five, because we like the number five now, there's five key areas or strategies, if you will, that in turn have the biggest influence on all of those five pathways. And part of this is that, you know, the reason we kind of come back to five actually is that one of the things that happens to people when they're diagnosed with cancer is they enter this super confusing, overwhelming, complicated world. All of a sudden they have to be some kind of medical expert and it's overwhelming. So we, you know, one of the things they want is simplicity. And so part of this is just to make it, even though it probably sounds complicated right now, is to make it fairly simple. There's five pathways, there's mm-hmm. five key strategies. Within each key strategy, we have five critical action steps and that's it.
Well, you know, another aspect of it is, in addition to being complicated, getting cancer is very disempowering, and I think a real important step is to provide patients with tools, things that they can do on their own, because all too often in conventional medicine, they, you know, you're told, look, you know, your cancer's being treated as well as possible, and you say, well, what shall I eat? What supplements? And many doctors say, well, you know, it doesn't make that much difference. So, you know, and that leaves patients feeling disempowered, and that is not a good emotion to have from the standpoint of your overall immune surveillance.
Totally agree. And that's, in fact, why we start our Five to Thrive plan with the first strategy being spirit. And we introduce the whole plan with this strategy of spirit just for the reason that you talked about, how because it's so impactful on, you know, our emotional state, our spiritual sense of well-being, our sense of purpose, the joy we have in life or don't have. Not only does that impact us on a physical and physiological level, but it impacts us on a motivational level too. So, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, yeah, we see cases, and many of us see this in our practice, or those who are not in medical practice see this in their daily lives, cases of people where a spouse might die, and just coincidentally, within 6, 12, 18 months, the other spouse is dead of a very aggressive cancer. Could this be the result of some blow to the immune system?
Yeah, you know, this is actually an interesting question, and I think one that a lot of patients ask themselves. I would say almost without exception, patients, when they're diagnosed, think back on their life in the last year or so and think about the stress that they're under and give that some causal role. So the question is that a legitimate thing to do or not? And the reality is that once a cancer is diagnosed, it's grown to the size that it can be imaged and found. It's been in there in all likelihood 20, 30 years, some maybe 10, but you know, anywhere between 10 and 30 years it's been growing from the very beginnings. But I think what can happen is that when we experience prolonged stress or severe stress, we can accelerate that growth in a sort of a dramatic fashion, so it seems as though the stress caused the cancer. I don't think it technically caused the cancer, right, but it could have accelerated it.
But we don't want to make people feel bad because somehow they've thought they've been thinking bad thoughts, or that they've allowed the cancer to develop, that it's their responsibility to be upbeat all the time and not to flag in their cheerfulness, because that's not realistic and that's not the way it works, really.
That's, you know, that's very important. And actually, I would add to that that the data shows that it's really about being authentic to how we are experiencing our world. The sense of false positivity or this sort of bravado that some people put on is actually not associated with increased survivorship. So that doesn't really help to kind of fake it.
Right.
It needs to be really just about being genuinely in touch with who we each are, what's important to us on a daily basis, and trying to realign our lives to participate in doing more of the things, being with more of the people that make us feel happy.
You mentioned one of the pathways that you actually feel is important enough to be a pathway in and of itself is insulin resistance. This has been getting a lot of attention lately in regard to heart disease and diabetes, but not so much cancer. So tell us about that.
Yeah, insulin resistance is actually quite an area of intrigue of mine, so much so that I'm giving several presentations on it this year, so I've done a lot of research into it lately. And so insulin resistance is interesting because cancer cells are very bad at making energy from sugar. So they need a lot of sugar in order to meet their energetic needs. And as a cancer tends to progress, it also becomes deranged in how it makes energy from sugar. So it converts from aerobic glycolysis, which is how a healthy cell makes energy, into something called aerobic, it goes from the citric acid cycle of making energy into aerobic glycolysis, which is a very inefficient way of making energy, but it has some interesting advantages for the cancer cell, and that is that it, in addition to making sugar, it creates some byproducts that the cancer cells use to make some of the other building blocks that they need to grow, some of the DNA that they need to make new DNA in their daughter cells and so forth. So it's kind of this weird adaptation. And as it turns out, when people have a lifelong or a very long-standing habit of pushing their sugar intake, so they're eating a lot of refined carbohydrates, they're sedentary, they're sleep-deprived, they have troubles balancing their sugar and their insulin levels, they can create a situation where they have a lot of extra insulin floating around in their blood, a lot of extra glucose or sugar floating around in their blood, which is exactly the combination that cancer cell is going to totally thrive in, because now it has a bunch of what it needs, inefficient as it is, to perpetuate its own growth.
So we see kind of a paradox in our thinking about cancer, because for so many years we were thinking, oh, it's meat and fat that is causing cancer. And clearly there's some studies that suggest that at the very least certain types of fat and certain types of meat, you know, perhaps the more processed or environmentally challenged products, full of pesticides and damaging xenoestrogens, these can actually promote cancer from the animal protein side, dairy and whatnot. But then the insulin resistance thing speaks to the issue of carbohydrates.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that what you just said is a really important point, because whenever we take this conversation about diet and make it too big or look at it from too high of a level, we're prone to creating errors in our thinking process. So fat in and of itself is not bad, but it's, like you said, the type of fat that can be a problem. So, you know, polyunsaturated and monosaturated fats, which we get through fish and olive oil and vegetables, are not linked with increased cancer risk, but commercially fed animal meat and commercial dairy is linked to certain cancers or certain risk of certain increased risk of cancers. Same is true for carbohydrates. So carbohydrates as a big category includes really healthy cancer preventive foods like vegetables, like fruit, like whole grains. But when we take the carbohydrate category and we look at simple carbohydrates, or these refined carbohydrates that really don't have any nutritional value anymore and are just basically sugar, then we get into a problem and a pretty strong link with increased cancer risk.
Well, boy, do I have a question for you then, because I actually was a little bit stymied by this question from one of my patients, and she sent me an article which shows that there is a linkage between high-fat dairy and breast cancer, and therefore the suggestion was that people consume low-fat dairy as an alternative to high-fat dairy. And in my discussion, I kind of picked up on both sides of this argument. On the one hand, the high-fat from dairy, that's not so great because of the residues of toxins and the xenoestrogens. But is low-fat dairy so great because it tends to minimize the fat, and then you may deliver a lot of dairy sugar or lactose, which can rev the insulin response.
Yes, and I think there's another element to that, and how I've answered this question, because patients have asked me the same thing, is that that study just correlated dairy intake with cancer risk. So they did not do anything in terms of looking at whether people were eating organically grown
right.
dairy, and I think that's a big, big difference. You know, as you move higher up in the food chain, all of the sort of ill-causing problems that we have in our food supply get concentrated. So there's more growth hormone in commercially fed cow milk. There's more pesticide residues. Both of those are strong risk factors for breast cancer risk. So maybe it was really that
right.
was the problem, not the dairy.
And looking at the modern commercial dairy industry, they're actually turning cows from, you know, formerly regular pasturing animals eating grass and walking around getting some exercise into sedentary animals that are basically giant udders that are being given chemicals and antibiotics with the goal of ever-increasing productivity where they're producing astronomical amounts of milk, which is great for the bottom line, but, like, God knows what you have to do to an animal, or would you have to pump into an animal to create such an over-secretion of the mammary gland of the cow?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I tend, philosophically anyway, if the data is a little uncertain, like in this regard, we don't know the answer to whether if it's an organic dairy solely, is low-fat better than high-fat or regular, or, you know, which is better. If we don't know the answer, I tend to go towards the least processed variety, because I think that we know that evolutionarily speaking, we've grown accustomed to handling certain foods the least processed they are. And the more we start to process foods, the more we manipulate their structure. And I think that's where we can get into some problems.
Well, it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and you know, there's no escaping it, because you watch NFL football and you see these big hulking linemen, and they're walking around with these little pink gloves. It's I call the color hooker pink. You know, it's a really, like, very bright, garish pink. Everything's pink. The little kerchiefs that they carry around to wipe their hands with, they're pink. And so, you know, we're bombarded with ads for breast cancer awareness. Are you happy with the direction that this program is taking? Because, I mean, certainly we have more breast cancer awareness, but do you think are we making true progress?
Well, you know, so on the positive side, I think that, you know, I remember, I'm not that old, but I do remember in my adult life there was a time when women were ashamed to
yes.
say the word breast in public.
Yes, exactly.
And so I think in the sense that we've made it very comfortable for people to talk about breast cancer, and there's an awareness, and really there's, you know, breast cancer is kind of at the prow, and behind that are all the other cancers. And so with the awareness that we've generated, there's more compassion, there's more interest in furthering our understanding, and ultimately, hopefully, some good treatment options. I think where we're missing the boat on this is that all of this effort, as good as it is targeted towards treatment, and there's really very little that's being put in towards prevention, and that ultimately is the only way that we're going to get a handle on this disease.
But you see, the surrogate for prevention, or the big, what they feature in terms of prevention, is let's make sure that all women have adequate insurance so that they can get their annual mammogram, because
right.
that's our best tool against prevention. Do you have problems with that assertion? I mean, certainly women should get better care. Everyone should have access to proper medical care. But is investing in that type of program, which is, you know, very expensive, and, you know, they're problems associated with mammography these days.
Yeah, so, you know, screening is certainly a component of prevention, and it does make, I think, a difference, because the earlier we detect cancer across the board, no matter what type, the better the opportunity there is to cure that person so that they can live a long life of being cancer-free. Having said that, you know, the real prevention opportunity is something that is going to make nobody no money,
mm-hmm.
which is about teaching people how to be active, how to sleep more, how to eat well, how to take the right dietary supplements. So true primary prevention, which will ultimately lower the chance of ever having anything show up on a screening test.
It's interesting that you mentioned sleep as a component in cancer prevention, particularly breast cancer prevention. How might that figure in? I mean, we're all sleep deprived. I mean, studies show that we've lost a couple of hours sleep since the advent of electric lights. I mean, it's enabled us to stay up late, and then we have all our entertainments. We have shift work. You know, we can be plugged in 24/7 these days. But as a result, people are sleeping less. So that, in some ways, encourages the development of cancer?
Yeah, you know, sleep is really interesting. There's actually some epidemiological data that looked at the rate of or the risk of developing breast cancer in women and in prostate cancer in men, and they've shown that women who obtain less than 7 hours of sleep a night have an almost 50% increased risk of developing breast cancer in their life. Same is true for men and prostate cancer. So we have these kind of large population studies. From a more mechanistic standpoint, it makes sense because a lot of the pathways that I mentioned earlier, the kind of resetting of those pathways towards health and away from disease happen when we're sleeping, and we need to get enough hours of good quality sleep so that we're actually cycling in and out of REM sleep to stimulate a lot of these innate resetting processes. You know, our immune system is reset during sleep. Our inflammatory pathways are toned down during sleep. We can, if we are insulin resistant and we're sleep deprived, until we correct that sleep deprivation, we will not be able to become less insulin resistant. So we must have good sleep in order to have good sugar balancing. So it's just really, I would say, foundational actually to our overall health.
You are actually a big proponent of melatonin for breast cancer prevention and even for during some phases of treatment. How does that fit in with the sleep equation?
Yeah, melatonin is very important. Actually, there's a lot of studies that have been published on melatonin, a lot of clinical trials in relationship to breast cancer, and all the trials have utilized actually a fairly large dose. So most people that are familiar with melatonin use it to help them sleep when they're taking between 1 to 3 milligrams. But in these trials related to cancer, they're actually using a dose of 20 milligrams at bedtime.
Mm-hmm. Which is a dosage we use at my clinic.
Yes, so at that dose, you get the sleep effects, which I call a side effect, pleasant side effect. But what you're really doing at that dose is you're using melatonin almost pharmacologically to sort of push the immune system specifically towards what we call cytotoxic immunity, or the cell-directed immunity, the very efficient part of the immunity that is able to see, target, and kill cancer cells. And that high dose of melatonin has pretty potent anti-estrogen effects, so it acts as an anti-estrogen, which is important in an estrogen receptor positive cancer. And then furthermore, at that high dose, melatonin turns on a process inside damaged cells called apoptosis, which is the cell suicide pathway. So it helps to kill cells in a very efficient way that are damaged to the point where they're not very viable. So it's a really useful agent, and it's been, you know, the data is pretty compelling in these trials. There's better disease-free survival, longer survival, higher quality of life in people taking melatonin.
Okay, so some women elect to undergo conventional cancer therapy, and you're not opposed to that. I mean, your approach is integrative. You're not an all-or-nothing alternative therapy proponent. You think that there's a place for both conventional therapy and alternative therapy, correct?
Right. I mean, I myself, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I ended up, consulting my many medical oncology colleagues across the country, and much to my dismay, I had a universal recommendation to go ahead and receive chemotherapy due to various characteristics of my cancer, radiation, and now I'm currently on tamoxifen. But throughout that time, I utilized, lifestyle-based program, dietary supplementation, and, you know, for me, when people are diagnosed with cancer, I just peel the labels off. I don't really care that much what we call it, conventional, alternative, whatever. All I want to do is find the most helpful, least harmful therapy. And, you know, chemotherapy sounds harmful, but in many cases, the benefit outweighs the harm for long-term survival. So,
right.
Yeah.
And that has to be a tough stance for you to take because you were president of a major naturopathic organization and, you know, probably comprises a broad spectrum of naturopaths, some of whom are very happy to work hand-in-hand with the conventional medical community. More and more naturopaths are working together with conventional doctors. But there are some who are, you know, dyed-in-the-wool, vitalist, total, you know, let's let Mother Nature work with natural remedies. So I guess you took a centrist approach and a pragmatic approach.
Yes, I did. And I think that, you know, I'm also happy that there's that continuum out there, to be frank, because I think there are some people for their own reasons who don't want or, you know, are not candidates for conventional treatment and really are looking for alternative treatment only. So I'm glad there's people on that end of the continuum, if you will, that I can refer mm-hmm. patients to that want that approach. But I also think that yeah, it is a continuum, and I think being in the middle of that continuum allows me to examine things from a very sort of objective standpoint because I apply the same standards to anything I incorporate. So I'm really just searching for what do I think is going to be the most helpful for somebody.
And you don't just do it out of you know scientific objective interest. This is literally you're making, in a sense, life and death decisions that apply to yourself.
Right, yeah. I have a lot of personal investment in this.
Indeed.
For sure.
That'll certainly get you to pore over the scientific literature with greater attention. But so what do you do when you encounter the attitude among many conventional oncologists? Hopefully this attitude is changing gradually, but still I encounter it, where they say, look, you're going to get chemotherapy. You're going to get radiation. We don't know what all those supplements out there do. The vast majority are not approved or reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration. You don't know what you're getting out there. So just stay off the supplements. Or at best, they'll say, look, just take a one-a-day multivitamin, because, you know, all that other stuff, you know, the strange-sounding names, that could get in the way of the effectiveness of this, you know, the chemo or the radiation we're giving you.
I think that's a very legitimate, concern that, patients come to me with all the time, you know, and
They're stuck. I mean, they're like a deer in the headlights because they go to these, you know, my office is a nice looking office, but I can't hold a candle to Memorial Sloan Kettering, you know, with its vast halls and, you know, thousands of employees. It's a very impressive place. And when they tell you stop taking your supplements, you're going to hit the pause button.
Right. And I've taken a different approaches over the years. My current way of managing this is that when I see a patient, I do a medical chart note and I send that note to the patient and to their oncologist. So everybody is on the same page. They know exactly where I'm coming from. There's nothing hidden from anybody. Mm-hmm. That sort of serves a purpose in that the oncologist on occasion has looked at the note and said, wow, this person's obviously got some medical training. Mm-hmm. They're not out in left field. They're respecting
the therapies.
They're not
practicing voodoo. Yeah.
Right. So you know what? Maybe this is okay. So that's worked sometimes. Sometimes the oncologist will still say, I don't want you to do it. And in that case, then I really don't want to get into a fight with
right.
the oncologist
no,
and triangulate the patient.
It's very uncomfortable for the patient because, you know, they're very scared.
Right.
And, you know, you don't want to. They don't want to feel like they're in a tug of war between, you know, two diametrically opposed practitioners. It's a very tough place to be.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this dichotomy happens in all parts of medicine, but I think it's kind of got an infused with an extra
edge.
Strength. Yes,
yeah.
Oncology, because it is a life or death situation and the drugs and the therapies that oncologists are using are scary but you know, I think if an oncologist says, forget about it, don't do it, then there's usually a point, just like you mentioned, the multivitamin, or maybe they'll be okay with, you know, taking something for the week in between treatments, or there's some point in most cases that I can find a place where they're comfortable.
Common ground.
And then that allows the patient to feel that sense of proactive, I own a piece of my own care here, mm-hmm. and that my providers are actually working together to some extent. So I think in the end, that's actually a fine way to go. And then once they're done with the conventional treatment, you know, then I'm all in.
Right, because that's actually, look, that's what I sometimes say to patients. I say, look, okay, you know, your oncologist objects to what we're doing. So here's just a couple of things. These are not controversial things. Do these things for now. But come back to me when they pronounce you well, and then we can really go to town on diet, and preventive supplements, because they won't interfere. This won't be a time where there could be any possible conflict.
Right, and that's essentially that patient also is really what this Definitive Guide to Thriving After Cancer is oriented towards, because it's once people are through with their conventional treatment, all the support that goes with that drops away, mm-hmm. and people are left, like you said, scared, and they don't want to get cancer again. They don't really know what to do, and yet it's a prime opportunity for them because they've got a new layer of motivation. It's a prime opportunity to engage in a healthier life and right. to find things that give them a sense of wellness.
Did the cancer get your attention?
Right.
Sure it did, yeah.
Right.
It's a teachable moment, and it's an opportunity to make some, you know, actually sometimes I arrive at the conclusion with patients, you know, we just saw a gentleman who, he's at his 8-year point now in post-diagnosis of prostate cancer. It was actually in that wave of patients where they first began to say, you know, you could just have what's called watchful waiting. In those days, they called it watchful waiting. Now they call it active surveillance, where mm-hmm. we're not going to take out your prostate. We're not going to zap it with radiation. We're going to observe you. And we did the whole, you know, the full boat, you know, the diet, the lifestyle, the exercise, and a whole raft of supplements. And finally, we've arrived at a point where his PSA is low. His doctor has said, we don't need to do any more biopsies, so we'll monitor your PSA. And we've arrived at this point where, it's all seeming to pay off. But the conversation I have sometimes with patients at that point is, you know, cancer may have saved your life because you're going to survive your cancer. But so many people die prematurely of cardiovascular disease, of stroke. And you sure have stroke-proofed and heart disease-proofed your body with this excellent program. It works in a lot of ways to extend mm-hmm. Health and longevity.
Yeah, I think that's a great perspective to give people. And I think the other element to that is that it's really hard for somebody to be diagnosed with cancer and not stare at their own mortality at some level. So there's this deep shifting that happens in people. So not only, like you said, do they have the opportunity to gain more physical well-being and in that reduce their risk of all sorts of chronic diseases, but they have an opportunity to regain a true sense of vitality, which I think could otherwise have eluded them for their entire life. So in many ways, I think it's a gift for people.
Indeed, and that's a real positive way to look at it. But let's look at some tangible examples. I mean, your books are full of these examples, but let's look at an example first of where a commonly used supplement can interfere with a type of cancer therapy. And, you know, you might, on a casual visit to the health food store, they might say, oh, this is really great for cancer, but with the type of therapy that the person's getting, that might not be such a good idea. Or conversely, something which you really should be taking if you're getting a certain type of cancer therapy. Just one example of each, perhaps.
Okay. Well, let's see. I guess we'll take one. We talk about vitamin E, since that's something that people are probably quite familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So vitamin E has been studied in relationship to various side effects, if you will, of chemotherapy and radiation. One of the indications for it is when people receive a chemotherapy called cisplatin, mm-hmm. which one of the toxicities of cisplatin is neurotoxicity. So they develop peripheral neuropathy, numbness, tingling, their hands and feet typically. Mm-hmm. And when they take vitamin E concurrent with that chemotherapy and for continue on with the vitamin E after, their rate of peripheral neuropathy decreases significantly, more than half as few cases. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, very indicated
so really,
therapy.
They should be giving it out in hospitals.
They should, yes. Yep. On the other hand, if people are receiving radiation therapy, vitamin E should not be used because vitamin E can actually interfere with the effectiveness of the radiation therapy, and it will also help people feel better while they're getting the radiation therapy. Mm-hmm. But there was an interesting study, particularly if people are smokers, that if they take getting radiation therapy, they're taking vitamin E, that their risk of recurrence is increased mm-hmm. after the radiation therapy. Okay. So, you know, that's an example.
That's good. Is there a threshold? You know, because many multivitamins may have a little bit, you know, maybe 20 international units, and the more potent vitamin E supplements are 400, 800, or 1,000. Is there a threshold where that protective effect kicks in, or where the adverse effect might operate when you're taking radiation.
Yep. The most of the studies that show benefit are using around what's the equivalent of about 600 IUs, 400 to 800 IUs. Okay. You know, and I'll just make, you brought up another really good, interesting point, which is that the vast majority of research, including the research that I cited, is done on alpha tocopherol, which is just one component of vitamin E. And there's some very exciting research that's in its early stages, but it's on tocotrienols, which are a very lesser known part of vitamin E, particularly as anti-cancer agents themselves. Mm-hmm. Some really good research coming out, so definitely keep your eye out for that.
Okay, and you know, this is all a moving picture, and that's why we have individuals like you who are, you know, just poring over the literature. And you know, it's kind of a frustrating job because, like, you know, one week it's this, another week it's that, and you know, it takes a while before we know the answers. A lot of people say, well, you know, is this, tell me what to do, Doc. And the answer is sometimes, you know, we're learning. We're
right.
The research is underway, and it ain't rocket science yet.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, it, like you said, the nuances are pretty significant, which I think is also why it's so important for people, especially if they're in active treatment and they want to include some dietary supplements in particular, that they really find a qualified integrative healthcare practitioner to help them. Because it can be very, can be very detailed. Like, just as another quick example, there's a chemotherapy called Xeloda, which also produces this hand-foot syndrome, this peripheral neuropathy.
Right.
B6 is very effective. We've known about this for a long time.
B6 is good for peripheral neuropathy.
Yep. Good for peripheral neuropathy. But if you, and it's been shown that 200 milligrams is perfect. It does job really well. Mm-hmm. If you dose at 400 milligrams of B6 a day, then you still get good reduction in the neuropathy, but you actually have a higher rate of what we call treatment failure. So people don't start to interfere with the chemo. So that's just an example of a dose differential, which is going to be impossible for people to keep track of, and why it's so important to find expert help.
Yes, it's complicated, and that's why we as complementary physicians are constantly going to medical conferences and participating in webinars and reading. It's actually one of the things that appealed to me about the career in medicine is that it was going to be a career of lifelong learning. And, hopefully that's something that more doctors are going to be committed to in the future.
Yes, I agree. It's never a dull moment.
Indeed. So, all right. So speak to us a little bit about, the field of naturopathic medicine. I got to say that when I first went into medical practice, 25 years ago, naturopathy was just coming into its own. And, frankly, some of the naturopaths out there were using, I don't want to be disparaging, but they were using rather unscientific methods that, certainly could work, fasting, hydrotherapy, various types of herbal therapy, all these, though, were based on ancient traditions in some cases. You studied anthropology in college. Maybe that's one of the reasons you got into the type of medicine that you did, like I did, because I studied anthropology. I said, wow, there's really something to all these ancient practices. There may be some validity there. But now we have a highly trained, scientifically oriented naturopaths, some of whom are professors and instructors at universities, some of whom are on the faculties of major hospitals across the country. What's changed about naturopathy?
Well, gosh, I think a lot has changed, and I think that it really has evolved in the sense that, many of the practices, the core naturopathic philosophy and practices of using the healing powers of nature to stimulate our inherent or our innate ability to heal is still very much the guiding principle for how naturopathic doctors practice. But I think, like you alluded to, what's really changed in our profession is that we've recognized that we can't just guess at how to do that best, that we have this great tool called science available to us, and it's really important that we put our therapies to the rigor of scientific examination and to use the most scientifically valid, scientifically sound therapies. And so I think that's really what's changed. And as a result, the profession continues to grow. We have 19 states and provinces which regulate naturopathic medicine now. We just had a naturopathic medicine week last week, which was declared by the federal government. So, I mean, I think there's things that are moving forward with the profession. And, we're an emerging profession. We're still relatively small compared to medical doctors, certainly osteopathic doctors, but I think we have a unique voice and an important voice in that grouping.
Okay. And finally, I want you to weigh in on one of the most bitter controversies in integrative oncology, particularly as it relates to breast cancer. And this is a question that bedevils many of my patients and listeners. I constantly get bombarded with questions about this, and it has to do with the role of soy. Soy is looked at by some as something that can instantaneously kindle cancer. On the other hand, other people look at soy as potentially protective against cancer. So, you know, you've done a lot of research on this, and what has this led you to believe?
Well, if you look at the data that's been published since 2009 forward, which so that would be the most recent data set, all of those studies are consistent, and there are many prospective trials, which is a more rigorous trial design than the previous studies, that all of the studies that have been published from that point forward have demonstrated a survival benefit in women who consume whole food soy compared to women who do not. So it seems very clear from a literature standpoint that the consumption of soy foods, and by that I mean soy milk, tofu, tempeh, edamame, not these isolated soy proteins that you find in bars and powders and stuff like that. But
because that's refined soy.
Right. Yep. So whole soy food, and it's not that much. You know, these studies are showing at the equivalent of a glass of soy milk or half a cup of tofu that the risk of dying from the risk of recurrence of breast cancer decreases by about 15% or so. And the risk of in some studies goes up to about 33% in postmenopausal women. So I think that I would say soy is good. Now, do I tell people who have never had soy before to go out and eat soy every day? No, because there's plenty of other ways to reduce risk.
Right.
But if you like soy, there's no reason not to eat it.
Okay. The practical question is, what does Lise Altshuler consume? You're a breast cancer survivor. What is a typical breakfast, lunch, and dinner for you?
Wow, that's a good question. Well, my typical breakfast, which I just today thought, you know, I'm getting kind of tired of my breakfast. I got to change it up, but is a smoothie. So I have Vitamix. I put I steam some kale. I put the kale in there.
Kale smoothie. That's pretty hardcore.
Yeah, but I put fruit in there, lots of fruit, so it doesn't taste so bad. And then I put these chocolate flavonoid powder in there and some vegetable powder and some cinnamon and blend that all up. That's my breakfast and lunch because it's a pretty big smoothie.
What's the protein base for that in that?
I use a raw vegetable type of protein powder.
Okay, but not soy.
I don't use soy. I'm actually a little allergic to soy. So.
Oh, okay. Some people don't tolerate it or digest it very well. So it's a vegetable protein.
Yep.
Start with a vegetable protein. Okay.
So that's my kind of, let's call it brunch.
Okay.
And then later in the day, I usually get a little bit hungry, so I often will snack on some nuts, or I might have a piece of whole grain bread with some, you know, organic yogurt on it, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then dinners are pretty varied, but what I tend to go more towards is the American plate. Or my plate, I try to get it close to the new American plate, so I try to make it at least 50% color. So there's some vegetables in there, lots of different kinds, a lot of salads, things like that. And then of the other remaining 50%, maybe 50% is some kind of protein.
Mm-hmm. And you do consume animal protein?
I do, yeah. The land meat that I consume is grass-fed only.
Okay.
Avoiding
the potential for environmental pollutants or xenoestrogens and antibiotic residues.
Right, yep. And then I do enjoy, you know, whole grains like brown rice or quinoa or something like that. So, and I admit I have a bit of a sweet tooth, so sometimes I'll have a little bit of chocolate after dinner, or I might have some sorbet or something like that. That's kind of my typical day.
Okay, that sounds very doable. That doesn't sound austere at all. And I like the chocolate part because that's another thing that you and I have in common. I'm a big consumer of dark chocolate.
Yes.
So lots of these issues you're going to delve into in detail in your book, The Definitive Guide to Thriving After Cancer. And the website is, give it to us again, please.
5tothriveplan.com. That's all spelled out. 5tothriveplan.com.
Okay. And you've got a great podcast show. Actually, it's also broadcast on some radio stations as well. Tell us what, give us a sample of some of the things that you have in store for people this week on your, and how do they access it?
Yeah, we have, we've actually changed, we used to do this every night. We now do it Tuesdays and Thursdays on the Cancer Support Network, which is okay. W4CS.com. And the podcasts, will be available very soon on iHeartRadio Talk. But the show is basically the Tuesday portion is Carolyn Gazella, who is my co-author, and we have a dialogue about some component of this plan. And so this week we're going to talk about detoxification.
Cool.
And then on Thursdays we interview an expert. We've had you on the show. We have other experts in the integrative healthcare arena talking about a specific area of their expertise. And those are all great, great shows as well.
Right. Okay. And that's accessible through 5tothriveplan.com as well?
Yeah, there's a radio tab so people can find out more information about the show on the website.
Great. Okay, and I recommend it very highly because that's where I go to steal all my story ideas. So I do a little industrial espionage, you know, to see what the hot topics are. So you may occasionally see some of your guests popping up on my radio. No, not really, but
yeah.
But
as long as you're willing to come back on our show and be a guest, you're entitled to whatever you'd like.
Okay, I don't have to give you royalties or anything. No.
No, we'll talk about that later.
Oh, okay, off the air. All right, thank you very much, Dr. Lise Al Schuler, and for our spelling challenge listeners, it's not easy. It's L-I-S-E, first name, Al Schuler, A-L-S-C-H-U-L-E-R. Dr. Lise Al Schuler, a naturopathic physician and author of The Definitive Guide to Cancer, and The Definitive Guide to Thriving After Cancer, and co-host of the 5 to Thrive broadcasts. Thank you very much for joining us, and keep up the great work. You're certainly doing yeoman service, getting accurate scientific information out to people on integrative techniques for managing cancer.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hoffman. It's always a pleasure. I love doing your shows, I have to say, because you are clearly the most erudite, most scholarly of all interviewers I've ever been interviewed by. So I feel like I have to be on my toes with you, which is great.
Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, so we put you through the paces, but you did great. We really enjoyed having you. All right. Thank you very much, listeners, for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.